You and I back together again, Tuesday style, February 18th, 2025, on Connecticut Today. I had thoughts on a bill to ostensibly prevent so-called book bans in the state, which really, when you think about it, don't actually exist. CBS News reporter Jake Rosen joined us on confirmation hearings for Kash Patel to head the FBI under the Trump White House, and Yankee Institute blogger Megan Portfolio stopped by on her new analysis of state employee contracts going back to the administration of former Governor Dan Malloy back in 2017. I see we're playing with words again here, which we love to do just to make it sound like Armageddon, the end of the world. Here comes that big asteroid that's supposed to hit us in a few years. We'll have an update on that. So now all of a sudden we have book bans in Connecticut. Now, you and I know, as living, breathing individuals, we don't have book bans in Connecticut, but part of the Democratic majority, one Senator Bob Duff, wants you to think that books are banned in Connecticut, which is complete crap. You cannot ban the publication of any book. We don't do that here in the U.S. But a lot of folks in Hartford who want to make you think the sky is falling would just use words that make no sense. Now, again, this doesn't surprise me because we are in the era of calling a strip joint a gentleman's club. We're in the era of calling illegals migrants or undocumented persons. We're in the time where an AR-15, according to our attorney general here in the state, Mr. Tong, is a weapon of war, which it's not. Look, I'm not a gun owner here, but I've talked to enough gun owners to say, hey, does a soldier carry an AR-15? No, they don't. But Mr. Tong continues to say that. That's not me saying it. He has said it over and over again. Go look at the archive of statements he's made on his own website. Now, Mr. Tong apparently fancies himself some sort of rapper. If you heard what we've been playing for the past few days on WICC, including in Chris Williams' news, you just heard something about him going after President Trump, and he's got the nasty-looking video there with some sort of low-grade hip-hop behind. I have no idea. So instead of doing stuff substantively here in Connecticut, we're into words. And now, one of the legislative leaders, State Senator Bob Duff, Norwalk's own, Mr. Duff would gets up there in front of a microphone and uses the phrase book bans. There are no book bans in the state. The state does not ban books. We don't ban books in this country. You can maybe not get a major publishing deal, but you can self-publish your books. I know people that have done that. They've even made a few bucks. They're known as vanity publishers or vanity presses. Sometimes they're expensive. Sometimes they're not. This in the Connecticut News Junkie, Cora LaPonte's story. The General Assembly's Committee on Children heard public testimony Thursday on a bill to prevent book banning in the state. God almighty. You cannot ban a book in a state. But again, this is the same state where we call AR-15s weapons of war. We call illegals undocumenteds or migrants. Senate Majority Leader Bob Duff Norwalk spoke in support of the bill and sat for questions from committee members. Duff saying, quote, it's of the utmost importance that all perspectives, beliefs, and ideas be accessible through books. Okay. Nobody's arguing that. Often it's books addressing issues related to race, gender identity, and sexuality that are banned. No, we don't ban books. In Connecticut alone in 2023, there were 113 challenges against books in our libraries. Now, that there's a difference there. Proponents of banning books use the excuse of protecting kids from lewd material, but this is a cover to ban freedom of thought, endangering tolerance and weakening democracy. Senator, with all due respect, it's not. It is a push by some parents who think, for example, that young kids should not have ease of access to books that may promote, I don't know, sodomy. different sexual proclivities at a young age. This is not book banning. And we should have a healthy discussion about this. This has nothing to do with banning books. Stop saying that. This is why he said, I've received a multitude of emails of support of librarians and parents from around the state and around the country. Senate Bill 1271 would prohibit school or public libraries from censoring or excluding books due to their origin, authors, backgrounds, or view of the material. It would require public libraries and local school boards to create policies for book curation and removal, including ways to address concerns. Yes, but that has nothing to do with a book ban. We don't ban books in the state of Connecticut. There are books that are not banned in the country. Duff said the bill would provide school librarians and staff members with protections from criminal and civil liability. Okay, I'm for that. But here's what I don't understand. We have a movie rating system in this country, don't we? I think we still do, right? There's G. There's what? PG. There's PG-13. There's R. There's NC-17. So we acknowledge, even there's even TV ratings too. You can set your cable box or streaming box. I used to have a TiVo years ago. Do people still have TiVo? I don't know. So you could set those boxes, or you could refer to the movie rating system to make sure that stuff is age appropriate. Why is there such a pushback when we try to do the same things with books in libraries? I don't get it. 203-333-9422, 333-WICC. We don't ban books in this state. You can publish just about anything you'd like, either online or in a physical book. Now, there is a healthy debate we should have regarding access to that. And there's nothing wrong with a parent saying, hey, I just want my son or my daughter or my grandson or granddaughter or goddaughter or guardian, whatever, godson to or adopted child to make sure things are age appropriate. There is a big difference, is there not, between making sure stuff is age appropriate and banning books, which doesn't happen. CBS News justice correspondent and justice reporter Jake Rosen joining us now this afternoon. Jake, good afternoon. How are you?
Hey, good afternoon, Paul. How's it going?
Very well. Where do we stand with the Kash Patel nomination here? Because you read some things and some people praise this guy like he's out of heaven and other people liken this guy to a dictator. So you tell me, Jake, where do we stand on this?
Well, it appears that there will be a vote potentially sometime midday tomorrow, maybe earlier, maybe a little bit later, depending on what Congress decides to do to officially confirm him. It looks like he has enough votes to kind of clear the way. I think I remember the last time we talked, a lot of these cabinet officials or appointees were kind of in hot water or maybe had that question mark before a lot of their confirmation hearings and some private meetings with senators. It looks like, at least for now, Patel has, you know, kind of calmed the waters around his nomination as the other kind of nominees have gone through. You'll remember Kash Patel, you know, worked with Donald Trump to help overturn the 2020 election. You'll remember that he was actively involved in, you know, a lot of hot air around what Democrats were doing and, you know, podcast appearances and stuff like that. A lot of brazen kind of accusations. There have been some allegations on Capitol Hill, especially among senators and some congressmen, that potentially Kash Patel was dictating a lot of what we see in the news happening in the FBI lately, although there hasn't been any kind of hearing or further evidence of that yet. So, you know, it's been a lot has been going on, but it looks like at least for now he's calmed the waters around him and will be in office potentially tomorrow or the day after.
Yeah, and now you just mentioned the negatives around him, Jake. The people that you've talked to and you've read about and people who are four square behind him, They obviously, I guess, don't care about that. What kind of pluses, Jake, are they talking about? Why do they think Patel is a good pick for this?
I think it's pretty simple. And I think a lot of, especially someone as myself who's been in D.C. for a long time, there are institutional norms here that Trump took issue with as really the main central point in the grievances around his campaign, right? It was rooting out, quote, weaponization in the deep state. Well, Cash Patel wrote a book about that, saying he was going to either go after these people or here's what he accused people like Adam Schiff, Nancy Pelosi, you can, name names for hours about what they've done to either slow Trump or go after Trump. You know, and I also think that this kind of turnover we've seen, these resignations at the DOJ, there were more today, the legal moves that they did with Eric Adams, like they want to do these things to break some norms, to kind of, maybe it's just break some, put a bull in the china shop and see what's what's left standing, right? And I think that's really what, again, as someone who covered Trump, you just have to go back to, this is what his supporters voted for, was someone to potentially be in charge of the FBI to, quote, root out weaponization, potentially, reinforce the FBI in some ways, which is going after drug cartels and going after dangerous criminals, but also to shake things up and get the people who went after Trump out of the institution. And it's not right just reassigning them, right? It's potentially being gladly accepting their resignation offers if they don't like what's going on there.
Jake Rosen, Justice Reporter, CBS News. Jake, thank you as always. Be safe and we'll chat down the road. Thanks, Jake. Appreciate it.
All right,
take care. Yep, Jake Rosen, CBS News. All right, in about a year and change, they're going to get down to formal negotiations on a new state employee deal, CBAC, representing a bunch of unions here. Now, you remember one of the previous times this happened, you may remember this. Remember the guy, former Governor Daniel P. Malloy. Everything was always great under Governor Malloy. There were never any budget problems. He's now plying his trade as chancellor at the University of Maine system. And our next guest, Megan Portfolio, has gone back and looked at some of the numbers and whether or not they generated the anticipated savings that then Governor Malloy said were going to happen. Ms. Portfolio, good afternoon. How are you?
I'm doing well, Paul. How you doing?
I'm living the dream, Megan. What can I tell you? Nothing better than here. And plus, I'm getting too old for anything else. So, well, what am I going to do?
Same.
It is what it is. Listen, I like nothing better than playing gangster videos from William Tong on the program, too. But that's a whole
Oh, man. I'm going to have to catch some of those.
I hear he's going on tour. But I digress. I remember this, Megan. I'm glad you wrote about it. When Governor Malloy, then Governor Malloy, who's now up in the hinterlands of Maine, said, hey, we're going to do a great deal here that over the next few years is going to save money for the Connecticut taxpayer. What have you found out looking at these numbers?
Basically, that the state was pretty much peeing on our boots and telling us it was raining.
Okay.
So back in, sorry, hopefully that was a...
No, that's fine.
I tried to make that PG, but...
Don't worry. I'm glad you used that word and not the other, but go ahead.
Oh,
yes,
I would
yes.
never.
Yes,
oh, my
yes.
goodness.
Go ahead.
I'm a lady. Anyway, back in 2017, a million years ago, we were having serious budget issues. We could not close the budget. It was thankfully I wasn't in the state at that time because I probably would have lost my mind.
Okay.
But one of the things that they decided to do was the CBAC contract was up and they were going to give us some savings. And it was supposed to come out to about $24 billion in savings over two decades.
Yeah.
And the way they were going to do that, one of the main things was they were going to do a wage freeze for 2 years.
Yeah.
And that was supposed to save, year to date, a little over $1 billion. And it's just year after year, this report comes out. Actually, they used to not publish the report. I wonder why. And then they actually tried to get rid of the report.
I wonder why.
Nothing's materialized the way they say it was going to materialize.
Okay.
And my first point is not getting a raise isn't a savings because nobody that I know of is obligated to get a raise. Like you earn a raise. If times are good, you get a raise. If times are bad, you don't. I mean, there's been many years I haven't gotten raises.
Mm-hmm.
When I was in sales, they would tell us go sell more because we don't have the money right now for raises.
No, that's true. Yeah.
And it sucks and it's terrible. And people, it's nice to get that yearly raise, but it's not reality.
Mm-hmm.
So this report, it comes out every year and it showed yet once again, the raises or the savings we were promised didn't happen. Mm-hmm. And the funny thing about this is I pulled all the transcripts from when the lead negotiator for CBAC sits in front of the General Assembly making his case for why, you know, the workers should get raises. And every single time he uses this, I think he just uses the same speech that he wrote back in 2017. Oh, we've made these sacrifices. We made these concessions. But did you really make a sacrifice? You had a pay raise for 2 years. Mm-hmm. But what they did get was a $2,000 lump sum payment, guaranteed raises the 2 final years of the contract. And that contract in 2017, that was for their health benefits and pension. Mm-hmm. They extended that to 2027. That's unheard of, a collective bargaining agreement out 10 years. So I call BS on this concession and sacrifice, because not getting a raise isn't a concession. It was nothing tangible you gave up. You got a lump sum cash bonus on top of your other raises and the latter years of the contract. And they just keep playing the same tune over and over again. And our leaders, they fall for it. They get played over and over and over again. So I really wanted to write this piece, mostly just to remind them, like, you guys are getting played. There were no concessions. Not getting raises in a concession. You guys need to pay attention to this stuff. These state workers have done really well ever since Lamont took office. And I've said this numerous times on your show, 33% compound raises, raises and step increases. And that's just an average. A lot of the people that, you know, send me mean emails that work for the state, I look them up and they actually got, they're better off. They were actually 44% compounded raises in that time period.
44% raise. God almighty.
Yeah, it's 40. Insane. And Lamont's sitting down with these people right now, and they're saying these things over and over again. And, well, oh, we made concessions. No, you know who's made concessions? You and I. Back when they were not funding pensions in the 70s and 80s, you know, they would say things like, oh, you know, our kids and grandkids, you know, they're going to have to pay for that. Well, guess what? I'm that kid. I'm that kid from the 70s, and I am having to pay for it because we have, like, the most obscene taxes in this state. We're one of the highest tax states in the country. And the reason is, not mostly, but big part, because of this unfunded liability that we have. We just never funded the pensions, and the bills do, and we have to pay it.
And Megan, look, you and I both know this is never going to end. And I keep explaining to people it's because of electoral politics. Let's take a rough number. I know it varies from year to year, but there are, you know, 40,000 state employees, a lot of whom call this program on this issue and others. So if you have 40,000 state employees, now not everyone is married, not everyone has kids, but extrapolate out from those 40,000 or 35 or 40,000 state employees, probably 3/4 of them are married and there's kids too. So you and I both know that that base of 40,000 state employees probably, Megan, you know, translates, if you do the math, to 70, 80, 90,000, 100,000 votes. And that's that's the difference of who gets elected in this state. Once you get out of the urban areas and you go to the suburbs and balance off the voting, listen, they get what they want because as a block, they have incredible voting power.
Absolutely. I mean, I follow these people, and I would laugh during the summer. Oh, this is our 8th stop today, door knocking for so-and-so. And, oh, we're making phone calls for this person. So, I mean, they're not doing this out of democracy or the kindness of their heart or they believe in the cause. No, they're doing it because they want their pound of flesh.
Sure.
When their chosen candidates win elections, they're going to want their pound of flesh. And they get it every single time. And it's us, the taxpayers. Everyone else has to suffer. There's no equity. There's zero equity in this system whatsoever. Because all of us in the private sector, we've all suffered. And we've all made concessions because of this. I mean, we have special ed programs that aren't fully funded. That's absurd, Paul. The thought that we're not, I mean, it's your constitutional right to have a fair and free education. And those rights are being violated because we don't have enough money. But every time a CBAC contract comes up, we manage to have money for that.
We're
carrying $370 million in Governor Lamont's budget this year for more raises. And, I mean, when does it end?
And with a straight face, they say, well, you know, if we expand Husky and Medicaid to the highest point to cover illegals, hey, that's $250 million. And they say with a straight face, and meantime, like you say, there's other stuff you've got. You know, you've got nonprofits out there. You have charities begging for money. And they say, hey, I mean, look, before we talked, I just talked about, I don't know whether you saw that story in the Connecticut News Junkie, Stephanie Thomas from a couple of days ago saying, hey, we don't have enough money for early voting. Excuse me? How is that possible? How is that possible?
Because there's a caste system in the state, and we're at the bottom. We're at the bottom of the barrel. State employees are number one, and a number just came out. It was like $1.3 billion that we're paying for undocumented workers.
Yeah.
But what about then? But then there's like nonprofits, there's homeless, there's vets, there's the elderly. We all get the crumbs, but if you're the chosen few, if you provide votes, you get on the top of the list. So you get your piece of the pie. So now you're happy. And then the rest of us get to like divvy up the rest. And then if we can't make the, you know, the budget, we, you know, my taxes can always go up.
Yeah.
Why not? Just tax me some more.
Well, okay. Be careful. Don't say that, Megan, because
they
will.
I haven't done my taxes yet. I'm like cringing.
Oh, no.
I'm waiting to see what my big savings were.
My tax professional will be getting my W-2s and my 1099s soon on. Folks, if you want to read about this analysis Megan has done regarding the Lamont years, the governor now piloting the University of Maine system. How's that working out?
Megan, the Malloy math.
What?
Malloy math.
You like that, huh?
I love that.
Megan Portfolio, the Hartford Portfolio from the Yankee Institute. Megan, thank you. Have a spectacular week, and we'll talk next week, okay?
All right, sir. Have a great week.
All right, Megan Portfolio there. Check it out. Agree or disagree. Yeah, you know, you can email her, too. You'll call the station here. As we move right along right here on a Tuesday on WICC.